It's time for Security Now. Steve Gibson is here, and we have perhaps the most interesting story. What a way to kick off 2024, our first episode of the new year. And Steve breaks down what looks to be a massive conspiracy around the security of the last five generations of iPhone. The details coming up on Security Now.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
This is Security Now with Steve Gibson, episode 955 for Tuesday, January 2nd, 2024. The mystery of CVE-2023-38606. This episode of Security Now is brought to you by Bitwarden, the open source password manager trusted by millions. With Bitwarden, your digital life is secured with end-to-end encryption and is only accessible by you. Now, we know that AI has unlocked a whole new world of innovations and unexplored opportunities for individuals and businesses. But did you also know the information you enter into AI platforms can be used by hackers to attack and exploit end users? Balancing the potential of AI and the need for heightened security online is a daunting challenge. But the first step to use strong and unique passwords for every online account, that's where Bitwarden comes in. Easily generate and manage complex passwords with a trusted credential management solution like Bitwarden. And by the way, it supports passkeys too for true passwordless authentication. You can access your passwords, your passkeys, your sensitive information saved in Bitwarden across multiple devices and platforms for free forever, keeping your secure solution at work, at home, or on the go. At TWiT, we're fans of password managers. You know that. And the one I use, the one Steve uses, the only one we recommend, Bitwarden. Get started with their free trial of a Teams or Enterprise plan, or get started for free across all devices. Yep, for free across all devices. It's open source, kids. As an individual user, at bitwarden.com/twit. That's bitwarden.com/twit. It's time for Security Now, the show where we cover your privacy, your security, your safety online, how computers work, and a whole lot more with this guy right here, Steve Gibson, the autodidact who knows all, tells all, and is back again for 2024. Happy New Year, Steve.
Happy New Year to you, Leo. And I was pleased to see that we've got continuing sponsors in 2024 that'll be familiar to our audience.
Your show will never be hard to sell. People want to be on Security Now, that's for sure. But by the way, we're always looking for new advertisers. I don't want to discourage anybody.
No.
If you work for a company and you say, boy, I hear this a lot, they really ought to advertise on Security Now, by all means, contact us, advertising@twit.tv.
I can definitively state, Leo, that Apple will not choose to be an advertiser on this podcast.
Well, I can think of many reasons for that, but what do you mean?
Well, we know they have a very thin skin, right? Mm-hmm. Like, you know, you haven't been allowed back after you said one comment once or looked at your phone during a presentation or some nonsense.
Yeah.
I don't remember.
No, but I'm on a blacklist for sure, yeah.
This podcast has a very dry title, The Mystery of CVE-2023-38606.
Whatever could that mean?
Uh-huh. After everyone is updated with the state of my still continuing work on Spinrite 6.1, and after I've shared a bit of feedback from our listeners, the entire balance of this first podcast of 2024 will be invested in the close and careful examination of the technical details surrounding something that has never before been found in Apple's custom proprietary silicon. As we will all see and understand by the time we're finished here today, it is something that can only be characterized as a deliberately designed, implemented, and protected backdoor that was intended to be and was let loose and present in the wild. After we all understand what Apple has done through five successive generations of their silicon, today's podcast ends as it must by posing a single one-word question. Why?
Well, I think you're probably right. but I can't wait to. We talked a little bit about it on Mac Break Weekly, and I even said, I bet you Steve will have something to say about this. So I'm very, very interested in the deep details, the breakdown.
We got the details. Yeah. Everybody is going to understand it. We're left with some questions, not just one.
Yeah.
Like, how did this happen? Because there are things, unfortunately, we're never going to know, but there are definitely things we do know. And it really takes a little bit of the polish off the apple.
Oh, my.
Yeah.
Oh, my. Well, I'll be very interested to hear more about this. All right.
And we do have, oh, my goodness, a great picture of the week. I gave it a caption that really...
I actually like the caption. Can you say the word ad hoc in a sentence? I don't know what it means, but we will get to the picture of the week in just a moment. But first, a word from our sponsor. We love our sponsors, and Collide has been a sponsor with us for some time now. What do you call an endpoint security product that works perfectly but makes users miserable? Well, most of them. But in this case, the old approach to endpoint security is to lock down employee devices, to roll out changes through forced restarts. But you know what? It just doesn't work. IT is miserable because they've got a mountain of support tickets. Employees start using personal devices just to get their work done. And that's a nightmare. And executives, they opt out the first time it makes them late for a meeting. And now you've got a mess on your hands. You can't have a successful security implementation unless you work with end users, right? They're part of your team. That's where Collide comes in. Their user-first device trust solution notifies users as soon as it detects an issue on their device, teaches them how to solve it without needing help from IT, and that way, untrusted devices are blocked from authenticating, but users don't stay blocked. Collide is designed for companies with Okta, and it works on macOS, it works on Windows, it works on Linux, and mobile devices too, so it works everywhere you are. If you have Okta and you're looking for a device trust solution that respects your team but still gets the job done, visit collide.com/security now. Watch a demo today. See how it works. KOLIDE.com/security now. We thank them so much for their support of the show and Mr. Gibson. In 2024. All right.
So
picture of the week.
This picture was of an insane person, something that a crazy person did. Apparently, they were traveling somewhere in Europe.
Okay.
Where, you know, the plugs are two round pins, offset from the center.
Yeah.
But they had a U.S. standard two-prong, you know, straight prong power plug, and they couldn't, I guess, go downstairs to the hotel gift shop and buy themselves an adapter. So they managed to put one together.
Oh Lord, this is insane! Oh my God!
So I looked at this.
Would this work?
I gave this, although, you know, you want to keep your distance. I gave this the caption, please use the term ad hoc in a sentence. And the sentence is, this is a photo of an ad hoc EU to US power adapter.
It looks like he's got forceps and a key and a padlock.
There's forceps stuck in one of the round European outlet holes. And then there are on the U.S. plug, the two prongs have holes through them, as many of ours do. So the plug was one of the plug's holes was threaded through the handle of the forceps, giving it an electrical attachment to one side of the European power.
It's kind of clever because it's taking advantage of the hole in the U.S. plug.
Yes, that was clever. Well, then so does the padlock, which has been stuck, the hasp of the padlock has been stuck through the hole in the other prong of the U.S. plug. The padlock then closed, and of course, it's got a key and a linking it with a key ring to another key, and that second key is plugged into the opposing hole in the adjacent EU power outlet. Thus, completing the circuit.
If you use the
term circuit very loosely.
I'd be a little concerned about the impedance of the key ring.
That you're right. That little key ring loop, if you're drawing too much power from this thing, it's gonna get a little warm. Oh God. Anyway,
this is hysterical.
A great photo.
Don't ever try this at home, kids. This is not recommended. By any means.
We're not suggesting this. We're just saying, if you are really desperate,
You nobody's that desperate.
Then even don't do it.
No.
Okay, so as I mentioned 2 weeks ago, I was hoping to be able to announce that Spinrite 6.1 was finished, and really, it is all but finished. If I were not still making some incremental progress that matters, I would have declared it finished. I've been wrestling with the behavior of some really troubled drives. Like finally someone FedExed me. I paid the FedEx shipping because there was no way I was going to have a someone who's been testing Spinrite pay shipping. He FedExed me his drive Friday that arrived 3 days ago on Saturday. And because Spinrite was getting stuck at 99.9953% of the drive. Well, stuck is no good. It turns out it was that drive, it was a Western Digital, was returning a bogus status, which was tripping up Spinrite, which wasn't prepared for a ridiculous status byte coming back from the drive. So Spinrite's better now, and three other people's drives that were also getting stuck for the same reason no longer do. So, you know, it's like the edgiest of edge cases, but I want this thing to be perfect. And the things I'm doing will carry forward into the future. So I would have to do it sooner or later. I might as well do it now. Anyway, I need to give it a little more time to settle. But, you know, what I know is that as a consequence of this intense scrutiny at the finish line, this Spinrite really does much more than any version of Spinrite ever has before. So anyway, I'm just, you know, days away. Okay, so I have a couple bits of closing the loop feedback. This is interesting. This is from Rotterdam in the Netherlands. The subject was, which root certificates should you trust? Remy wrote, I made the tool requested in 951. He wrote, Hi, Steve. Happy Spinrite customer here. Can't wait for 6.1. In episode 951, you discussed root certificates, and Leo asked for a Prune Your CA app. You said, the good news is that this is generic enough that somebody will do it by the next podcast. He said, well, fun challenge, and I happen to know a bit of C++, so here is my attempt. And we have a link in the show notes. It is also this week's shortcut of the week. Anyway, he wrote, it parses the Chrome or Firefox browser history and fetches all certificates. It's a reporting-only tool that does not prune your root store, since I suspect, he says, that could break stuff. So if people want that, they can figure out how to do that themselves and make a backup. He says, I've compiled it as a 32-bit Qt 5.15 C++ application specifically for you. So it runs on Windows 7.
You've got a reputation, Steve.
And up. He says, Qt 6, the current version of the C++ framework, does not support Windows 7. Cheers, Remy. So, anyway, since I found this As I was pulling together today's podcast, I've not yet had the chance to examine it closely. But I quickly went over to Remy's page, and it looks like he has done a very nice piece of work.
It's very cool. Yeah.
Yeah. He and I don't know if you noticed, but there are counts on each on the number of instances of each of those certificates that he found.
Mm-hmm.
So he, and he's also supporting by he's sorting by the most hits on a given cert, and not surprisingly, Let's Encrypt is up there at the top.
Right.
Anyway, so he provides an installer for Windows users with the full source code. So for Linux users, he suggests installing Qt and compiling his what he calls cert util from the provided source code. He's deliberately removed all Google ads, Google, and other tracking from his site. So he suggests that if you find his work useful, you might perhaps buy him a cup of coffee. The link to Remy's page, as I said, is this week's GRC shortcut. So grc.sc/955, and that'll just bounce you directly to Remy's page. And so, Remy, thanks for this.
This is read only, and I understand his reluctance to put a surgical tool in there. But how hard, if once seeing these, how hard would it be to remove them? Is there a mechanism for that manually?
Sure. Well, under Windows, down in the search box, put MMC and hit enter. That brings up their desktop. Yeah, MMC enter, and there it is. And so that brings up. And yes, you want to run it. Yep. And that so then you go to file, up on the file menu, and add snap in. Add remove snap in. Now find cert and add that. Oh, you have to move it into the box on the right.
You can't just click it. You have to drag it.
Yeah. Okay. Add, remove, snap
so
in.
So here's the certificates, cert, snap
and
in.
And then click on that little thing. That
oh, I see. Add it here. I get it. Oh, yeah. I haven't used this in
there
a while. All right.
And got my account.
It. There it is. And now certs are in there. And basically, now I can see my certificates.
Now you've created a certificate viewer, which allows you to see all the certs you've got on your machine.
And the one you care about is Trusted Root, right?
Yes, and if you look, click there. Under
oh, there you go.
There they all are.
Now, let's say I don't want Komodo. Can I right click on it and delete?
Yep. Yeah. Yep.
So you totally can do that manually, one by one.
You absolutely can.
Okay.
Yep. And we'll see how this goes, because this also could be automated. All the certs are in the registry. This is basically a convenient viewer into the registry that does a lot of interpretation for you too.
This is good. I mean, honestly, this is the tool that's kind of sufficient. It's just that you have to do a onesie twosie.
Well, and you got to know which ones. So his cert util
that's useful
shows you
to report
given your entire current browser history.
Right.
What certificates has your browser ever touched?
And what hasn't it touched? Because there's a whole listing of unused CAs. Yeah, and those are the ones you might consider removing.
Yeah, Actalis. Who's ever heard of IT Milan Actalis?
It's Italian. Know? It's an Italian.
I don't think we need them.
Yeah, we don't need them.
You know, we don't. And of course, what this means is anything they ever sign, our browser absolutely trusts. You know, that's the great danger of this whole system,
right,
is that it's carte blanche trust for every single certificate in our root.
And as you pointed out when we first started talking about this, there's only a handful of certs that do 90% of the traffic into your computer.
Seven certs gives you 99.96% of all non-expired browser certificates.
I could probably remove the China Financial Certification Authority from
my EV roots.
I have a feeling I won't be needing that.
Yeah. Now your light switch might not work anymore, but still.
That's the question. What is the you would get it would tell you this is an untrusted site. But you still
Correct.
Could go to it. You could bypass
Absolutely.
It.
Absolutely. You could push past it, and, you know, maybe that's what you want, is something that says, whoa, wait a minute, why am I going
Hold
to
on,
the
cowboy.
Chinese laundry?
Yeah.
I don't really need that.
I don't need that one. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Very handy.
So,
thank
Remy,
you.
Thank you.
Good job, Remy. Yeah.
Martin Bergick was referring to last week's Schrodinger's Bowls picture of the week, or rather 2 weeks ago. This was great. He said, showed the picture of the week to my son, age 13. He immediately gave the obvious answer. Break the top glass.
Oh.
Obviously, that is cheaper to replace than the plates. And he
said, very clever.
Yes. He said, slightly annoyed. I didn't come up with it myself. Well, none of us did, Martin. But happy that the future is looking bright. So
that's great.
Anyway, yeah, the upper glass was in front of an empty shelf. So you could break the glass, then, you know, lift the shelf and have full access to all the bowls that are precariously, you know, trying to fall, but are being held in place by the pane of glass below that. So very, very clever. Sammy 222 tweeted at SGGRC, Steve, I planned to use DNS benchmark today. When I ran the download by VirusTotal, three security vendors flagged this file as malicious. While I trust you, I wanted to check in case there is a problem with the file. Thanks. Okay, so I just dropped the file on VirusTotal, and at the moment I did, four of the AV tools at VirusTotal dislike it. Now, I'll note, however, that they're all rather very obscure AV, so it's not Google or Microsoft or anybody. And since GRC's DNS benchmark is approaching 8.8 million downloads at a rate of 4,000 per day, I suppose it's a good thing that not everyone is as cautious as Sammy222, or there would be, you know, a lot more concern than is being expressed. But seriously, I poked around a bit in VirusTotal because it like allows you to see what things are setting off alarm bells. And, you know, I looked at the behavior that is concerning to VirusTotal, and I can't really say that I blame it. The program's behavior, you know, if you didn't know any better, would peg it as some sort of bizarre DNS DOS zombie. You know, it scans network adapters. It's chock full of every DNS server you can imagine. You know, there's 505 of them or something.
It does look kind of suspicious, come to think of it. Yes.
Yeah.
Good point.
And, you know, it's got all sorts of mysterious networking code, you know. Unfortunately, this is the world we're living in today. It doesn't matter that program, which has been around since, 2007 or something, I think I wrote it, you know, it's never hurt a single living soul, and it never would. You know, it's even triple SHA 256 signed with various of GRC's old and new certificates, all of them valid. Do the signatures matter? Apparently not. It still looks terrifying. So anyway, to answer your question, Sammy, the file's code has not changed in nearly 5 years since I tweaked it, I think, to add 1.1.1.1 or something, you know, some or 9.9.9.9, some updated server I wanted to put in there. And that was 5 years ago. You know, it's never actually harmed anyone yet. I can understand why VirusTotal would go, you know, so, yeah. Anyway, I'm pretty sure you can rely on it being safe. Christian Nilsson said, hello, Steve. I'm one of all those who's glad you decided to go past 3E7 hex. So we know that's 999 in decimal. He said, thank you. Speaking of tail scale, etc., I strongly recommend Nebula Mesh. Open source all the way and very easy to manage. I know it's been on your radar before. What's the reason for not advocating it in SN953? Christian, no reason at all. I just forgot to mention it among all the others. And I agree 100% that Nebula Mesh, which was created by the guys at Slack, is a very nice-looking overlay network. We did talk about it before. Slack wrote it for their own use because nothing else that existed at the time, this was back now 5 years ago in 2019, did what they needed out of the box. So they rolled their own. Nebula Mesh's home on GitHub is under Slack HQ's directory tree. And I have the link in the show notes, but you can just search Nebula Mesh to locate it. It's a fully mutually authenticating peer-to-peer overlay network that can scale from just a few to tens of thousands of endpoints. It's portable, written in Go. It has clients for Linux, Mac OS, Windows, iOS, Android, and even my favorite Unix, FreeBSD. So absolutely, thank you for the reminder. And for those who are looking for a good, you know, 100% open, unlike Tailscale, where they are keeping a couple of the clients closed source and the Rendezvous server, which those nodes need to find each other, closed, Nebula's 100% open. So again, Christian, thanks for the reminder. Ethan Stone said, "Hi, Steve. I've noticed something recently that you might be interested in. First on my Windows 10 machine, then on my Windows 11 machine. The Edge browser has kept itself running in the background after I close it. Excuse me. The only way to actually shut it down is to go into Task Manager and manually stop the many processes that keep running after it's closed. I noticed this because as one of your most paranoid listeners," he says, Parenza, "I know that's a high bar. I have my browser set to delete all history and cookies when they shut down." Boy, he must like logging into sites. "And I have CC Cleaner doing the same thing if they don't. CC Cleaner seems to have caught on to Microsoft's little scheme and now notes that Edge is refusing to shut down and asking me if I want to force it. Anyway, it seems like it's just another little scheme to keep all of my data and activity accessible to their grubby little data selling schemes. And actually, I think it's probably just, you know, who knows what. They figure just get more RAM if you don't want Edge continually running. Actually, what it probably is it allows it to launch onto your screen much more quickly when you start it again, right? Because it never really stopped. So it's still there. It just turned off the UI. So you click on the icon and it's like, bang. It's like, whoa, okay. So anyway, I understand you want things that you don't need and that you stop to actually stop. That's a good thing. He finally says, "I love the show, and I'm looking forward to new ones in 2024 and the advent of SpinRite 6.1, although I really, really, really need native USB support. So I hope SpinRite 7 isn't far behind. Also, I'm looking forward to not having to log in to Twitter to send you messages, although please give priority to SpinRite 7. Okay, so I have been gratified with the feedback from Twitter users that they're looking forward to abandoning Twitter to send these short feedback tidbits. My plan is to first get SpinRite 6.1 finished. As I said, that's just like moments away. Okay, but then I need an email system, which I don't currently have, in order to notify all version 6.0 owners through the last 20 years, because it was in 2004, I began offering 6.0. So I need, you know, an email system to let them know that it's available, and basically of what has turned out to be a massive free upgrade to 6.0. So that need will create GRC's email system, and we'll experiment then with my idea for preventing all incoming spam without using any sort of heuristic false positive tendency filter. And then I plan to immediately begin working on SpinRite 7. I don't want to wait for several reasons. For one thing, I currently am SpinRite. I have the entire thing in my head right now. You know, my dreaming at night is about SpinRite. And I know from prior experience that I will lose it if I don't use it. You know, I barely remember how Squirrel works now. So I want to immediately dump what's in my head into the next iteration of SpinRite code. Another reason is that that Ethan referred to is about USB. Unfortunately, USB is still SpinRite 6.1's Achilles heel. All of SpinRite has historically run through the BIOS, but I've become so spoiled now by 6.1's direct access to drive hardware that the BIOS now feels like a real compromise. Yet even under 6.1, all USB connected devices are still being accessed through the BIOS. Since SpinRite's next platform, which I've talked about, RTOS 32, already has USB support, although not the level of support required for data recovery, that's what I'll be adding. Still, it made no sense for me to spend more time developing USB drivers from scratch for DOS when, at least something I can start with is waiting for me right now under RTOS 32. So, yes, I'm in a hurry to get going on SpinRite 7. It'll be happening immediately. And then I had already replied to Ethan, and when I checked back into Twitter, he had replied to me. And he wrote again, okay, but please spend less time on the email thing than you did on Squirrel. And so, yes, I am not rolling my own email system from scratch this time. I've already purchased a very nice PHP-based system that I've just been waiting to deploy. So I'll be making some customizations to part of it, but, you know, that's it. And then we'll have email. Okay, Leo, I'm going to catch my breath. You tell us why we're here. And then, oh boy, we're going to.
So the whole show is going to be this Apple thing?
Yes.
Holy cow. There is a lot to talk about.
Some other things happened, but they pale in comparison to what we now absolutely know that Apple has done.
Well, and they said in the information that it was ARM devices, other ARM devices might also be susceptible.
All iDevices,
A12, but ARM makes A12, stuff A30. Like my Pixel phone. No, not my Pixel. My Samsung phone is ARM-based. So that, well, we'll find out.
Yep.
We'll find out. And as far as I know, those CVEs have been patched on Apple devices, but we'll find out about that as well.
Well, we're going to find out why this was here for 5 years.
Yeah. Ooh. Wow. I used your name in vain on MacBreak Weekly. I said, if there's one thing I've learned from listening to Steve for almost 20 years is interpreters are a problem.
I heard you. Yes. Yeah. And you're absolutely correct.
We know that. Well, let's first talk about Melissa, our sponsor for this segment of Security Now. Data expires. If you have a customer list, a contact list, a supplier list, that kind of thing, your data is going bad, up to 25% a year. And that's why you need to know about Melissa, the data quality experts. For over 38 years, Melissa has helped companies harness the value of their customer data to drive insight, maintain data quality, and support global intelligence. Melissa is flexible to fit into any business model. And they've been doing address verification for, what is it now, almost 30 years, 38 years, almost 40 years, for more than 240 different countries. That means you're going to only get valid billing and shipping addresses in your system. You can focus your spending on where it matters most. Melissa offers free trials, sample codes, flexible pricing. There's an ROI guarantee, and of course, unlimited technical support to their customers all over the world. You can even try it for free. You can download the Melissa Lookups apps on Google Play or the Apple App Store. They're free. No sign-up is required. Very useful for onesie, twosie validation. Melissa has also achieved the highest level of security status. They are FedRAMP authorized. So that's huge. That means that gives you some security that you know that your data is being treated with kid gloves as it deserves. Melissa's solutions and services are GDPR compliant, CCPA compliant. They meet SOC 2 and HIPAA high trust standards for information security management. They treat your data like gold. You should be treating your data like gold. Make sure your customer contact data is up to date because it is gold. Get started today with 1,000 records cleaned for free. Melissa.com/twit. M-E-L-I-S-S-A. Melissa.com/twit. We thank them so much for their support of Security Now. Okay, let's get the CVEs here.
I have, in the past, suggested that you buckle up. And this is no exception.
I don't have a seatbelt on this bicycle seat that's attached to a stick.
Well, that's right. You're not on the ball anymore. That's good. That's good.
I will plant my feet firmly.
Plant your feet
on terra firma.
Firmly apart. Okay. Our longtime listeners may recall that during the last year or so, we mentioned an infamous and long-running campaign known as Operation Triangulation, which is an attack against the security of Apple's iOS-based products. This breed of malware gets its name from the fact that it employs canvas fingerprinting to obtain clues about the user's operating environment. It uses WebGL, the web graphics library, to draw a specific yellow triangle against a pink background. It then inspects the exact high-depth colors of specific pixels that were drawn because it turns out that different rounding errors used in differing environments will cause the precise colors to vary ever so slightly. You know, we can't see the difference, but code can. And since it uses a triangle, this long-running campaign has been named Operation Triangulation. Okay, in any event, the last time we talked about Operation Triangulation was in connection with Kaspersky. I heard you putting the accent on the second syllable, and I went and checked, Leo, and you're exactly right. I have been always saying Kaspersky, but it's Kaspersky.
So, I just put myself in the kind of the mind of Boris Badenov.
The Russian.
And I say,
Russian
how would
mind.
Boris Badenov pronounce it? Kaspersky. And then that's how
right.
I say it. Yeah.
That's right. Well, you got it right. Okay. We talked about it with Kaspersky Labs because someone had used it, that is this Operation Triangulation attack, to attack a number of the iPhones used by Kaspersky's security researchers. In hindsight, that was probably a dumb thing to do, since nothing is going to motivate security researchers more than for them to find something unknown crawling around on their own devices. Recall that it was when I found that my own PC was phoning home to some unknown server that I dug down, discovered the Oriate spyware. As far as I know, coining that term in the process, since these were the very early days, and then I wrote Opt-Out, the world's first spyware removal tool. My point is, if you want your malware to remain secret and thus useful in the long term, you need to be careful about whose devices you infect. Although we haven't talked about Kaspersky and the infection of their devices for some time, it turns out they never stopped working to get to the bottom of what was going on. And they finally have. What they found is somewhat astonishing. And even though it leaves us with some very troubling and annoying unanswered questions, which conspiracy theorists are already having a field day with, what has been learned needs to be shared and understood because thanks to Kaspersky's dogged research, we now know everything about the what, even if how and why will forever, probably, remain unknown. And there's even the chance that parts of this will forever remain unknown to Apple themselves. We just don't know. Kaspersky's researchers affirmatively and without question found a deliberately concealed, never documented, deliberately locked, but unlockable, with a secret hash, hardware backdoor, which was designed into all Apple devices, starting with the A12 chip, the A13, the A14, the A15, and the A16. This now publicly known backdoor has been given the CVE, which is today's podcast title, thus CVE 2023-38606. Though it's really not clear to me that it should be a CVE, since it's not a bug. It's a deliberately designed in and protected feature. Regardless, if we call it a zero day, then it's one of four zero days, which, when used together in a sophisticated attack chain, along with three other zero days, is being described as the most sophisticated attack ever discovered against Apple devices. And that's a characterization I would concur with. Okay, so let's back up a bit and look at what we know thanks to Kaspersky's work. I can't wait to tell everyone about 38606, but to understand its place in the overall attack, we need to put it into context. The world at large first learned of all this just last Wednesday on December 27th, when a team from Kaspersky presented and detailed their findings during the 37th four-day Chaos Communication Congress held at the Congress Center in Hamburg, Germany. The title they gave their presentation was Operation Triangulation, What You Get When Attack iPhones of Researchers, which I think is a perfect title because, yeah. On the same day last Wednesday, they also posted a non-presentation description of their research on their own blog titled Operation Triangulation, The Last Hardware Mystery. I've edited their lengthy posting for the podcast, and I'm not going to go through all of it, but I wanted to retain the spirit of their disclosure, since I think they got it all just right, and they did not venture into conspiracies. So after some editing for clarity and length, here's what they explained. They said, today, on December 27th, 2023, we delivered a presentation titled Operation Triangulation, What You Get When Attack iPhones of Researchers at the 37th Chaos Communication Congress held at the Congress Center, Hamburg. The presentation summarized the results of our long-term, it is multi-year, research into Operation Triangulation conducted with our colleagues. This presentation was also the first time we had publicly disclosed the details of all exploits and vulnerabilities that were used in the attack. We discover and analyze new exploits and attacks such as these on a daily basis. We've discovered and reported more than 30 in-the-wild zero days in Adobe, Apple, Google, and Microsoft products. But this is definitely the most sophisticated attack chain we have ever seen. Here's a quick rundown of this zero-click iMessage attack, which used four zero days and was designed to work on iOS versions up to iOS 16.2. Okay, so attackers send a malicious iMessage attachment, which the application processes without showing any signs to the user. This attachment exploits the remote code execution vulnerability, and these are all CVE 2023, so I'm going to skip that. So it's the remote code execution vulnerability 41990 in the undocumented Apple-only adjust true type font instruction. This instruction had existed since the early 90s until a patch removed it. It uses return slash jump oriented programming and multiple stages written in the NS expression NS predicate query language, patching the JavaScript core library environment to execute a privilege escalation exploit written in JavaScript. This JavaScript exploit is obfuscated to make it completely unreadable and to minimize its size. Still, it has around 11,000 lines of code, which are mainly dedicated to JavaScript core and kernel memory parsing and manipulation. It exploits the JavaScript core debugging feature, $VM, to gain the ability to manipulate JavaScript core's memory from the script and execute native API functions. It was designed to support both old and new iPhones and include a pointer authentication code bypass for exploitation of recent models. It uses the integer overflow vulnerability 32434 in the OS's memory mapping syscalls to obtain read-write access to the entire physical memory of the device. It uses hardware memory mapped I/O, MMIO, registers to bypass the page protection layer, known as PPL by Apple. This was mitigated as that CVE that is this podcast's title, 38606. A lot more on that in a minute. After exploiting all the vulnerabilities, the JavaScript exploit can do whatever it wants to the device running spyware, which is to say it is, at this point, the iDevice, because this is in all the A12 through A16 chips in all of Apple's devices. The device is cracked wide open. At this point, they've achieved absolute dominance. So they say, after exploiting all the vulnerabilities, the JavaScript exploit can do whatever it wants to the device, including running spyware. But the attackers chose to A, launch the IAM agent process and inject a payload that clears the exploitation artifacts from the device, and B, run a Safari process in invisible mode and forward it to a web page with the next stage. The web page has a script that verifies the victim, and if the checks pass, receives the next stage, the Safari exploit. The Safari exploit uses 32435 to execute shellcode. The shellcode executes another kernel exploit in the form of a mock object file. The shellcode reuses the previously used vulnerabilities 32434 and 38606. It is also massive in terms of size and functionality, but completely different from the kernel exploit written in JavaScript. Certain parts related to exploitation of the above-mentioned vulnerabilities are all that the two share. Still, most of its code is also dedicated to parsing and manipulation of the kernel memory. It contains various post-exploitation utilities, which are mostly unused. And finally, the exploit obtains root privileges and proceeds to execute other stages which load spyware. And those subsequent spyware stages have been the subject of previous postings of Kaspersky. Okay, so now I'm going to summarize this and then we're going to zero in. The view we have from 10,000 feet is of an extremely potent and powerful attack chain, which, unbeknownst to any targeted iPhone user, arranges to load in sequence a pair of extremely powerful and flexible attack kits. The first of the kits works to immediately remove all artifacts of its own presence to erase any trace of what it is and how it got there. It also triggers the execution of the second extensive attack kit, which obtains root privileges on the device and then loads whatever subsequent spyware the attackers have selected. And all of that spyware has full reign of the device because that subsequently loaded spyware is under, you know, obtains the permission of these kits. So it uses CVE-41990, a remote code execution vulnerability, in the undocumented Apple-only adjust true type font instruction. That's where it begins. With that still somewhat limited but useful capability, it uses living off the land return jump-oriented programming, meaning that since it cannot really bring much of its own code along with it at this early stage, instead, it jumps to the ends of existing Apple-supplied code subroutines, threading that together to patch the JavaScript core library just enough to obtain privilege escalation.
So they call that living off the land.
Right.
Because you're not using, you can't put much of your own code in there. So you have to use existing code.
Right. And it just jumps to the just before other subroutines.
So there might be a little
return
memory there somewhere that you can.
Yep. There are a few little instructions just before a subroutine finishes and returns. And they're able. So all they can do is like jump to a sequence of the ends of existing code in subroutines as like little bits of worker code, threading that together to achieve what they want.
Now, to do that, you have to know exactly where that stuff lives, right? You have to have the actual memory address. That's why address randomization works, right? Because
Address space layout
Apple
randomization.
Doesn't do ASMR, though, I guess, with this code.
Well, remember that they said the bulk of that code is analyzing the kernel memory. So it's looking for all of these things in order to figure out where everything is.
So it may be moving around, but they look for a chunk and they recognize it and they say, oh, it'd be right after this, wherever that is.
Yep.
Holy cow. This is so sophisticated.
They find like an API jump table and then know that the fourth API in that table will be taking them to the subroutine, the end of which they need.
So that's why ASMR doesn't always work, even if you use it. Because
it definitely makes the task far more difficult, but here they're using it, and they've managed. So it really raises the bar, but it could still be worked around.
Right.
So after that, they have obtained privilege escalation by using the JavaScript core library's debugging features. Then they're able to execute native Apple API calls with privilege.
Oh, my God.
It then uses another vulnerability, 32434, which is an inner overflow vulnerability in the OS's memory mapping system API, to obtain read-write access to the entire physical memory of the device.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, that's different than the normal access, because normally you are constrained
to read, like a program
is constrained to what you have access to. So they use an integer overflow, another 0 day, to get read-write access to the entire physical memory. And read-write access to physical memory is required for the exploitation of the title of this podcast, CVE-38606, which is used to disable the entire system's write protection. Normally, you can't change anything. You can't write anywhere. And so they figured out how to turn off write protection.
Okay, that's
so
amazing.
So far,
this is what the most sophisticated hacks often do, is chaining vulnerabilities.
Yes.
And you slowly escalate your capabilities till you get what you want.
Yep.
Wow.
Okay, so far we've used three vulnerabilities: 41990, 32434, and 38606. The big deal is that by arranging to get 38606 to work, which requires read-write access to physical memory because that's how it's controlled, this exploit arranges to completely disable Apple's page protection layer, which Apple calls PPL. It is what provides the great deal of the modern lockdown of iOS devices. Here's how Apple themselves describes PPL in their security documents. They said, under page protection layer, in iOS, iPadOS, and WatchOS, is designed to prevent user space code from being modified after code signature verification is complete. Building on kernel integrity protection and fast permission restrictions, PPL manages the page table permission overrides to make sure only the PPL can alter protected pages containing user code and page tables. The system provides a massive, this is Apple, a massive reduction in attack surface by supporting system-wide code integrity enforcement, even in the face of a compromised kernel. This protection is not offered in Mac OS because PPL is only applicable on systems where all executed code must be signed.
So what's interesting is this comes after system integrity is complete. So you've verified, you go, okay, we're going to make sure everything's good. Everything's good.
Lock it down.
Lock it down, and you've gotten in after that.
Yeah. The key sentence here was the system, PPL, the system provides a massive reduction in attack surface by supporting system-wide code integrity enforcement, even in the face of a compromised kernel. So that means that defeating the PPL protections results in a massive increase in attack surface.
Sure, because it's assumed you're good.
Right.
Oh.
Once those first three chained and cleverly deployed vulnerabilities have been leveraged, as Kaspersky puts it, quote, the JavaScript exploit can do whatever it wants on the device, including running spyware. In other words, the targeted AI device has been torn wide open. Okay, now, the next thing Kaspersky does is to take a closer look at the subject of their posting and of this podcast. But before we look at that, I need to explain a bit about the concept of memory-mapped I.O. From the beginning, computers used separate input and output instructions to read and write to and from their peripheral devices, and read and write instructions, you know, read and write, to read and write from to and from their main memory. This idea of having separate instructions for communicating with peripheral devices versus loading and storing to and from memory seemed so intuitive that it probably outlasted its usefulness. What this really meant was that I.O. and memory occupied separate address spaces. Processors would place the address their code was interested in on the system's address bus. Then, if the I.O. read signal was strobed, that address would be taken as the address of some peripheral device's register. But if the memory read signal was strobed, that the same address bus would be used to address and read from main memory. To this day, largely for the sake of backward compatibility, Intel processors have separate input and output instructions that operate like this, but they are rarely used any longer.
As with a lot of stuff, it was for efficiency, right? So peripheral devices could just sit there, and then every once in a while, instead of it was like a spooler to the printer. Instead of having to wait for the printer to hack it and all that, you just stick it there and the printer gets it when it wants it, basically.
Well, yes. And for example, behind me, we have my PDP-8
sure
blinking
used it.
Boxes.
Yeah.
So when you only had 12 bits mm-hmm. of address space, which is 4K,
right.
you don't want to give any of that up to peripheral I/O. You need every single byte to be actual memory. So the idea was that the peripheral devices occupied their own memory space, or I'm sorry, their own not memory space, their own I/O space.
Right.
I/O space was separate. It was completely disjoint from memory space. And so you access the I/O space with I/O instructions and memory space with standard read and write instructions. Okay, so to be practical, one of the requirements is that the system, if you want to, I jumped ahead. What happened was that someone along the way realized that if a peripheral's device hardware registers were directly addressable, just like regular memory, meaning in the system's main memory address space right alongside the rest of actual memory, then the processor's design could be simplified by eliminating separate input and output instructions. And all of the already existing instructions for reading and writing to and from memory could perform double duty as I/O instructions.
Because it's all in the same spot now. It's all in the RAM.
Right.
Yeah.
So to be practical, one of the requirements is that the system needs to have plenty of spare memory address bits. But even a 32-bit system, which can uniquely address 4.3 billion bytes of RAM, can spare a little bit of space for its I/O.
Probably not a lot of space, right? I mean,
right. And that's exactly what transpired. So, for example, when today's SpinWrite wishes to check on the status of one of the system's hard drives, it reads that drive's status from a memory address near the top of the system's 32-bit address space. Even though it's reading a memory address, the data that's read is actually coming from the drive's hardware. This is known as memory mapped I/O, because the system's I/O is mapped into the processor's memory address space and discrete input-output instructions are no longer used. And for example, in the case of ARM, they don't even exist. If, you know, ARM has always been memory mapped I/O.
Interesting.
So
just by pulling that address, you trigger a transfer from the I/O device. You're not really reading RAM. You're reading the I/O device.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And, you know, if you've got 64 bits of address space, you don't even have anything in most of that space.
Yeah, right. Right.
So today's massive systems, and by massive, I mean an iPhone, because it has grown into a massive and complex system.
Yeah.
You know, they use 64-bit chips
with
ridiculously large memory spaces. So all of the great many various functions of the system, you know, fingerprint reader, camera, screen, you know, crypto stuff, enclave, all of that stuff are reflected in a huge and sparsely populated memory map. Okay, now in the past, we've talked about the limited size of the 32-bit IPv4 address space and how it's no longer possible to hide in IPv4 because it's just not big enough. The entire IPv4 address space is routinely being scanned. This is not true for IPv6 with its massive 128-bit address space. Unlike IPv4, it's not possible to exhaustively scan IPv6 space. There's just too much of it. So here's my point. When there is a ton of unused space, it's possible to leave undocumented some of the functions of memory mapped peripherals. And there's really no way for code to know whether anything might be listening at a given address or not. And not only that, there may be too many addresses to reasonably check.
There could be millions.
Billions, trillions, gazillions.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think...
Oh,
I think
this is interesting. So this reminds me of the old peek and poke commands, right?
Yeah.
On older machines like Commodores and Ataris, you'd peek an address or you'd poke an address. And sometimes that would be an I.O. Like if you wanted to write to the hard drive, you'd poke it to an address and it wouldn't be a memory address. It'd poke it to the hard drive. So that's still built in to modern processors. In fact, it sounds like more so because there are many, many more devices attached.
Yes.
Or things.
Yes. Yes. Wow. And it is so convenient to just be able to use the existing architecture of reading and writing to and from actual memory to do the same with your peripherals.
It's a clever hack. And you know what that means.
What Kaspersky discovered was that Apple's hardware chips from A12 through A16 all incorporated exactly this sort of hardware backdoor. And get this, this deliberately designed in backdoor even incorporates a secret hash. In order to use it, the software must run a custom, not very secure, but still secret. I mean, it's not crypto quality, but it doesn't need to be, hash function to essentially sign the request that it's submitting to this hardware backdoor. Here's some of what Kaspersky's guys wrote about their discovery. And note that even they did not discover it because it's explicitly not discoverable.
Mm.
They discovered its use by malware, which they were reverse engineering. The question that has the conspiracy folks all wound up is, how did non-Apple bad guys discover it?
Yeah, where did they get the information of where to peek and poke?
And we're going to be spending some more time on that.
Because presumably they couldn't brute force it. They couldn't go through every address and see what
happened. It is not brute forcible, as we'll see. In the section of their paper titled, "The Mystery of the CVE-2023-38606 Vulnerability," Kaspersky wrote, "What we want to discuss is related to the vulnerability that has been mitigated as 2023-38606. Recent iPhone models have additional hardware-based security protection for sensitive regions of the kernel memory." This is the PPL they're talking about. "This protection prevents attackers from obtaining full control over the device if they can read and write." That is to say, even if they can read and write kernel memory, as achieved in this attack by exploiting CVE-32434. So the point being, even if you have read and write to kernel memory, you still can't do anything with it. That's what PPL, Apple said, protects from, right? This thing is so locked down that you still can't get into user space. They said, "We discovered that to bypass this hardware-based security protection, the attackers used another hardware feature of Apple-designed systems on a chip. If we try to describe this feature and how the attackers took advantage of it, it all comes down to this. They are able to write data to a certain physical address while bypassing the hardware-based memory protection by writing the data, destination address, and data hash to unknown hardware registers of the chip unused by any firmware. Our guess is that this unknown hardware feature was most likely intended to be used for debugging or testing purposes by Apple engineers or the factory, or that it was included by mistake. Because this feature is not used by the firmware, we have no idea how attackers would know how to use it. We're publishing the technical details so that other iOS security researchers can confirm our findings and come up with possible explanations of how the attackers learned about this hardware feature. Various peripheral devices available in the system on chip may provide special hardware registers that can be used by the CPU to operate these devices. For this to work, these hardware registers are mapped to the memory accessible by the CPU and are known as memory mapped I/O. Address ranges for MMIOs of peripheral devices in Apple products, iPhones, Macs, and others, are stored in a special file format called the device tree. Device tree files can be extracted from the firmware, and their context can be viewed with the help of the DT, stands for device tree, utility. While analyzing the exploit used in the Operation Triangulation attack, I, wrote the Kaspersky researcher, discovered that most of the MMIOs used by the attackers to bypass the hardware-based kernel memory protection do not belong to any MMIO ranges defined in the device tree. In other words, they're deliberately secret. The exploit targets Apple A12 through A16 Bionic systems on a chip, targeting unknown MMIO blocks of registers, which we have documented. He said, "This prompted me to try something. I checked different device tree files for different devices and different firmware files. No luck. I checked publicly available source code. No luck. I checked the kernel images, kernel extensions, iBoot, and coprocessor firmware in search of a direct reference to these addresses. Nothing. How could it be that the exploit used MMIOs that were not used by the firmware? How did the attackers find out about them? What peripheral devices do these MMIO addresses belong to? It occurred to me that I should check what other known MMIOs were located in the area close to these unknown MMIO blocks. That approach was successful, and I discovered that the memory ranges used by the exploit surrounded the system's GPU coprocessor. This suggested that all these MMIO registers most likely belonged to the GPU coprocessor. After that, I looked closer at the exploit and found one more thing that confirmed my theory. The first thing the exploit does during initialization is write to some other MMIO register, which is located at a different address for each version of Apple's system on chip. In the show notes, I have a picture of the pseudocode that Kaspersky provided. It shows an if CPU ID equals, and then a big 32-bit blob, and the comment is CPU family ARM Everest Sawtooth A16. And if it's equal, it loads two variables, base and command, with two specific values. Then, else if CPU ID and another 32-bit blob, that refers to CPU family ARM Avalanche Blizzard A15. And if that CPU ID equal is met, it loads two different base and commands into those values. And so forth for A14, A13, A12. In other words, all five CPU families from Bionic A12, 13, 14, 15, 16 require their own something. And what we learn is that it's their own special unlock in order to enable the rest of this. It is different for each processor family.
Wow. I mean, it seems like Apple did a good job with this. That's what's Interesting,
oh,
right?
Leo, wait. They did a great job with this. There's more. Kaspersky's posting shows some pseudocode for what they found was going on. Each of the five different Apple Bionic A12 through A16 is identified by a unique CPU ID, which is readily available to code. So the code looks up, the malware code, looks up the CPU ID, then chooses a custom per processor address and command, which is different for each chip generation, which it then uses to unlock this undocumented feature of Apple's recent chips. Here's what they said. With the help of the device tree and Siguza's utility, PMGR, Power Manager, he said, I was able to discover that all these addresses corresponded to the GFX register in the Power Manager MMIO range. Finally, I obtained a third confirmation when I decided to try to access the registers located in these unknown regions. Almost instantly, the GPU coprocessor panicked with a message of GFX error exception class and then some error details. This way, I was able to confirm that all these unknown MMIO registers used for the exploitation belonged to the GPU coprocessor. This motivated me to take a deeper look at its firmware, which is written in ARM code and unencrypted. But I could find not anything related to these registers in there. I decided to take a closer look at how the exploit operated these unknown MMIO registers. One register located at hex, and this I put this in the show notes just to give everyone an idea of how just obscure this is. One register located at hex 20604000 stands out from
I think that's like, more than 999. I think that's a pretty large number. Yes,
it is. He says it stands out from all the others because it is located in a separate MMIO block from all the other registers. It is touched only during the initialization and finalization stages of the exploit. It is the first register to be set during initialization and the last one during finalization. From my experience, it was clear, he said, that the register either enabled or disabled the hardware feature used by the exploit or controlled interrupts. I started to follow the interrupt route, and fairly soon I was able to recognize this unknown register and also discovered what exactly was mapped to the register range containing it. Okay, so through additional reverse engineering of the exploit and watching it function on their devices, the Kaspersky guys were able to work out exactly what was going on. The exploit provides the address for a direct memory access, a DMA write, the data to be written, and a custom hash which signs the block of data to be written. The hash signature serves to prove that whomever is doing this has access to super secret knowledge that only Apple would possess. This authenticates the validity of the request for the data to be written. And speaking of the hash signature, this is what Kaspersky wrote. They said, now that all the work with all the MMIO registers has been covered, let us take a look at one last thing, how hashes are calculated. And Leo, let us take a look at our last sponsor for the podcast.
This is amazing.
And we're going to continue.
Wow.
Yes, it is really truly astonishing.
Yeah. I'm super curious what you think about it, but we'll get to that in just a little bit. But first, a word from our sponsor, the great folks at Drata. You know, we've talked about them before on the show. With Drata, companies can complete audits, monitor controls, and expand security assurance efforts to scale. With a suite of more than 75 integrations, Strata streamlines your compliance frameworks, providing 24-hour continuous control monitoring. So you can focus on scaling securely. Strata easily integrates through applications such as AWS and Azure and GitHub and Okta and Cloudflare, and that's just scratching the surface. Strata's automated dynamic policy templates support companies new to compliance by using integrated security awareness training programs and automated reminders. They'll ensure smooth employee onboarding. As the only player in the industry to build on a private database architecture, Strata ensures your data can never be accessed by anyone outside your organization. And all Strata customers receive a team of compliance experts, including a designated customer success manager. They'll even do pre-audit calls so you can prepare for when the audits begin. And auditors and users alike love Strata's Audit Hub. That's the solution to faster, more efficient audits. You'll save hours of back-and-forth communication. You'll never misplace crucial evidence. You could share documentation instantly all in one tool. Say goodbye to manual evidence collection. Say hello to automated compliance when you visit Drata.com/twit. Drata.com/twit. Bringing automation to compliance at Drata speed. Drata.com/twit. I thank him so much for supporting this very important program. Breaking down. But we should mention, though, Apple has patched all four CVEs. And, right?
Hardware's still there.
Oh. So but, is some of this not patchable? Is that what you're saying?
No. It has been closed. And we're absolutely going
to
get
to
there.
That. Okay. Yeah. I just want to say that up front so people don't go, oh, no, and, you know, put their iPhone in a steel blind box or something.
Just definitely update it.
Yeah. Keep it updated.
Okay.
Yeah.
So Kaspersky says, now that all the work with all the MMIO registers have been covered, let us take a look at one last thing. How hashes are calculated. The algorithm is shown, and as you can see, it is a custom algorithm, and Leo, it's in the show notes on the next page, on page 11 on my show notes.
It's a lookup table, right?
They said, I'll get there. With a hash is calculated by using a predefined S-box table. He says, I tried to search for it in a large collection of binaries, but found nothing.
Huh.
You may notice that this hash does not look very secure, as it occupies just 20 bits. But it does its job as long as no one knows how to calculate and use it. It is best summarized with the term security by obscurity.
You'd have to know the values in this S-box.
Every single value.
Because they're random. They're not consecutive or anything like
correct.
That.
Correct.
Yeah.
He said, how could attackers discover and exploit this hardware feature if it is never used and there are no instructions anywhere in the firmware on how to use it? Okay, so to break from the dialogue for a second, in crypto parlance, an S-box is simply a lookup table.
In this case, 256 values?
Exactly.
It looks like? Yeah.
It's typically an 8-bit lookup table of 256 pseudo-random but unchanging values. The S of S-box stands for substitution. So S-boxes are widely used in crypto and in hashes because they provide a very fast means for mapping one byte into another in a completely arbitrary way. The show notes shows, as I said, this S-box and the very simple lookup and XOR algorithm below that's used by the exploit. It doesn't have to be a lot in order to take an input block and scramble it into, basically, it is a 20-bit secret hash. So the $64,000 question here is, how could anyone outside of Apple possibly obtain exactly this 256-entry lookup table, which is required to create the hash that signs the request? which is being made to this secret, undocumented, never seen hardware, which has the privileged access that allows anything written to bypass Apple's own PPL protection. Some have suggested deep hardware reverse engineering, you know, popping the lid off the chip and tracing its circuitry.
Wow.
But because this is a known avenue of general vulnerability, chips are well protected from this form of reverse engineering. And that sure seems like a stretch in any event. Every one of the five processor generations had this same backdoor, differing only in the enabling command and address.
Did they have the same S-box?
Yes, same S-box.
Yeah, they want to change that every time. Huh?
Some have suggested that this was implanted into Apple's devices without their knowledge, and that the disclosure of this would have come as a horrible surprise to them. But that seems far-fetched to me as well. Again, largely identical implementations with a single difference across 5-year separation generations of processor.
Mm.
And then to have the added protection against its use or coincidental discovery of requiring a hash signature for every request. To me, that's the mark of Apple's hand in this. If this was implanted without Apple's knowledge, the implant would have been as small and innocuous as possible, and the implanter would have been less concerned about its misuse, satisfied with the protection that it was unknown, that there was this, you know, undocumented set of registers floating out in this massive address space that only they would know about. They would want to minimize it. Add to that the fact that the address space this uses is wrapped into and around the region used by the GPU coprocessor. To me, this suggests that, you know, that they had to be the GPU coprocessor and this had to be designed in tandem. Okay, after Apple was informed that knowledge of this little hardware backdoor had somehow escaped into the wild and was being abused as part of the most sophisticated attack on iPhones ever seen, they quickly mitigated this vulnerability with the release of iOS 16.6. During its boot up, the updated OS unmaps access to the required memory ranges through their processor's memory manager. This removes the logical to physical address mapping and access that any code subsequently running inside the chip would need.
Doesn't that break stuff, though? I mean,
no, just that. I mean, it wasn't supposed to be there anyway.
Oh.
So it's literally just those critical ranges. The Kaspersky guys conclude by writing, "This is no ordinary vulnerability. And we have many unanswered questions. We do not know how the attackers learned to use this unknown hardware feature or what its purpose was. Neither do we know if it was developed by Apple or it's a third-party component like ARM CoreSight. What we do know and what this vulnerability demonstrates is that advanced hardware-based protections are useless in the face of a sophisticated attacker as long as there are hardware features that can bypass those protections. Hardware security very often relies on security through obscurity, and it is much more difficult to reverse engineer than software. But this is a flawed approach because sooner or later, all secrets are revealed. Systems that rely on security through obscurity can never be truly secure." That's how they end. And Kaspersky's conclusions here are wrong.
Oh.
The Kaspersky guys are clearly reverse engineering geniuses. and Apple, who certainly never wanted knowledge of this backdoor to fall into the hands of the underworld for use by hostile governments and nation states, owes them big time for figuring out that this closely held secret had somehow escaped. But I take issue with Kaspersky's use of the overused phrase security through obscurity. That does not apply here. The term obscure suggests discoverability. That's why something that's obscure and thus discoverable is not truly secure, because it could be discovered. But what Kaspersky found could not be discovered by anyone, not conceivably, because it was protected by a complex secret hash. Kaspersky themselves did not discover it. They watched the malware, which had this knowledge, use this secret feature, and only then did they figure out what must be going on. And that 256 entry hash table, which Kaspersky documented, came from inside the malware, which had obtained it from somewhere else, from someone who knew the secret. So let's get very clear, because this is an important point. There is nothing whatsoever obscure about this. The use of this backdoor required a priori knowledge, explicit knowledge in advance of its use. And that knowledge had to come from whatever entity implemented this, period. Also, we also need to note that as powerful as this backdoor was, access to it first required access to its physical memory-mapped I.O. range, which is and was explicitly unavailable. Software running on these iDevices had no access to this protected hardware address space, so it wasn't as if anyone who simply knew this secret could just waltz in and have their way with any Apple device. There were still several layers of preceding protection which needed to be bypassed. And that was the job of those first two zero-day exploits, which preceded the use of 38606. So we're left with the question, why is this very powerful and clearly meant to be kept secret faculty present at all in the past five generations of Apple's processors? I don't buy the argument that this is some sort of debugging facility that was left in by mistake. For one thing, it was there with subtle changes through five generations of chips. That doesn't feel like a mistake. And there are far more straightforward means for debugging. You know, no one hash signs a packet to be written by DMA into memory while they're debugging. That makes no sense at all. Also, the fact that its use is guarded by a secret hash reveals and proves that it was intended to be enabled and present in the wild. The hash forms a secret key that explicitly allows this to exist safely and without fear of malicious exploitation, without the explicit knowledge of the hash function. This is a crucial point that I want to be certain everyone appreciates. This was clearly meant to be active in the wild, with its abuse being quite well protected by a well-kept secret. So again, why was it there? Until Apple fesses up, we'll likely never know.
So let me, before you go on, does this functionality have any purpose that we know of? Is it used in any way by any Apple?
No.
No.
And that's the point. There
it's
is
weird.
No
it's in there.
There is no reference to it.
Yeah.
And that's what the Kaspersky guy looked for. He looked everywhere. Nothing uses it. There is no reference to it anywhere.
So if implies it might have been put in there for this purpose. I mean, what purpose?
That's what I believe.
What other purpose could, if it's not being used currently, made some extreme efforts to not only put it in there, but to protect it. You have a 256-byte secret that presumably, like, one Apple engineer knows, you know, and it's kept under lock and key in a basement office somewhere in Cupertino.
Right.
Would the chip manufacturers know this hash?
All they see is a mask, which they are imbuing on the silicon.
They can't see it.
Nope.
So there is a secret here, which Apple holds, presumably holds tightly, to a functionality which nobody apparently uses except maliciously.
Yes.
Well, that's interesting.
That is exactly it. Okay, so could this backdoor system have always been part of some large ARM silicon library that Apple licensed without ever taking a close look at it? Okay, well, that doesn't really sound like the hands-on Apple we all know. But it's been suggested that this deliberately engineered backdoor technology might have somehow been present through five generations of Apple's custom silicon without Apple ever being aware of it. One reason that idea falls flat for me is that Apple's own firmware device tree, which provides the mapping of all hardware peripheral into memory, the documentation of the mapping, accommodates these undocumented memory ranges without any description. Unlike any other known component, nowhere are these memory ranges described. No purpose is given. And Apple's patch for this, that's what this CVE fixes. Apple's patch for this changes the descriptors for those memory ranges to deny, to prevent their future access.
Well, that further confirms that there's no reasonable use for this. If you could just turn it off, and it doesn't break anything.
Right.
It's not being used by anybody.
That's right.
But it's in there, and it's carefully put in there.
Yep. The other question, since the hash function is not obscure, it is truly secret, is how did this secret come to be in the hands of those who could exploit it for their own ends? No matter why Apple had this present in their systems, that could never have been their intent. And here I agree with the Kaspersky guys when they say, quote, "This is a flawed approach because sooner or later all secrets are revealed," unquote. Somewhere, as Leo, exactly as you said, people within Apple knew of this backdoor. They knew that this backdoor was present and they knew how to access it. And somehow that secret escaped from Apple's control.
Do you think it's possible Apple put that in there at the behest of a government, a China or Russia?
Well,
as a backdoor. Okay. And yeah, we have a backdoor you can use.
That's two paragraphs from here.
Okay, keep going. Sorry.
What we do know.
You got my mind going. This is fascinating.
This is very good, Leo. Now you know why we're talking about nothing else this week.
Yeah.
What we do know is that for the time being, at least, iDevices are more, that is after this patch, more secure than they have ever been, because backdoor access through this means has been removed after it became public. But because we don't know why this was present in the first place, we should have no confidence that next generation Apple silicon won't have another similar feature present. Its memory mapped I/O hardware location would be changed. Its hash function would be different. and Apple will likely have learned something from this debacle about keeping this closely held secret even more closely held. Do they have a secret deal with the NSA to allow their devices to be backdoored? Those prone to secret conspiracies can only speculate. And even so, it does take access to additional secrets or vulnerabilities to access that locked back door. So using it is not easy.
Could Apple, though, have gone to somebody and said, here's the step-by-step? They would know. I mean, it does involve this font resizing and TrueType to get in the first place.
Yeah, those are two particular 0 days. As we know, Apple is constantly patching against these 0 days.
Yeah.
Right? So
they may have a more direct access to this that doesn't require a 0 day, perhaps.
Well, remember, this thing has been in place now since the A12.
5 years.
Yes. Yes. So it's been blocking things, yet people have still been getting in. This may have been used for a long time, and Kaspersky finally just found it.
And we don't know. The reason they found it was embedded on iPhones of many Kaspersky employees.
Yes.
But what we don't know is who did that. It's almost certainly a nation state. Would you agree? It's got to be Fancy Bear or somebody, right?
It was a mistake to attack Kaspersky. Now the world knows, and Apple turned it off. Was Apple forced to turn it off?
Wow.
Are they glad they turned it off? Were they surprised? You know, I would prefer to believe that Apple was an unwitting accomplice in this. You know, that this was an ultra-sophisticated supply chain attack, that some agency influenced the upstream design of modules that Apple acquired and simply dropped into place without examination, and that this was, you know, that it was this agency who therefore had and held the secret hash function and knew how to use it. As they say, anything's possible. But that stretches credulity farther than I think is probably warranted. Occam's razor suggests that the simplest explanation is the most likely to be correct. And the simplest explanation here is that Apple deliberately built a secret backdoor into the past 5 most recent generations of their silicon. One thing that should be certain is that Apple has lost a bit of its security shine with this one. A bit of erosion of trust is clearly in order, because 5 generations of Apple silicon contained a backdoor that was protected by a secret hash whose only reasonable purpose could have been to allow its use to be securely made available after sale in the wild. And that leaves us with the final question, why?
And we can only speculate. I mean, we don't know who put it on the Kaspersky iPhones. Could have been the Russian government. Much more likely, the U.S. government, the NSA.
Somebody had knowledge, yes.
It's speculation, but it's not a long stretch to think that the NSA required a backdoor of Apple. Apple complied. Gave the NSA,
made it super inaccessible.
Made it hard.
Safe. It was safe to use.
If you were going to design a backdoor, Steve, this is how you would do it.
Yes. Yes. It is absolutely safe. And so, yes, you're right, Leo. The NSA could have said, you know, we require a means in. You know, make it secure.
And they
made
could have
it
done
secure.
It, and we know because of the Patriot Act, they could have done it with a national security letter that would require Apple not reveal that this had been done.
Ever. And certainly allowed Apple to foreclose it the instant it became public. And they did. And as I said, there is nothing now that would lead us to believe it will not reappear under a different crypto hash in the next iteration of silicon.
Well, and not to be conspiracy theory minded, but there's nothing to make us think that every other phone manufacturer hasn't done the same thing for the NSA.
Now, one interesting thing, and maybe this will come out after people have had a chance to look at other ARM silicon.
That's a good question. You know, is this an ARM problem?
If this was inherited by an upstream supply, we would expect other devices to have the same thing.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's what's unknown. Is this Apple only?
Is this exclusive to Apple, do other devices have this too?
It looks like it is, though. Yes,
you have to catch it in use. I mean, Kaspersky only caught it because they had malware that was doing it.
It makes for, by the way, an excellent spy novel or movie, because the secret is a 256 byte chunk that could be sitting on any variety of things. It could be put in a JPEG with steganography. It makes for a very interesting spy novel. Possibly the NSA got to an Apple engineer, but it'd have to be the Apple engineer. I can't imagine this secret was held by many people. Maybe not by any one person at all. If I were Apple, I'd split it up. Very interesting. Yeah. Very interesting. The most obvious explanation is, as you said, the NSA and a secret backdoor.
Said you have to put this in. Yeah. We need access.
Yeah. And in which case, maybe you can't find fault with Apple, because that's the problem with being a business in the U.S. You have to follow the laws of whatever country you're doing business in, whether it's China or the U.S. They're not in Russia anymore.
And Apple could argue it is safe. I mean, what they did, it might as well not exist, except for the fact that that the secret got loose. Well, or maybe it didn't. Maybe the NSA still has it closely held. On the other hand, reverse engineering the malware.
It hasn't leaked out. That's right. We only know it because we've got the malware. Right. You know, somebody in the Discord is pointing out, Bad Rod points out that both the Chinese government and the Russian government have, within the last year, forbidden the use of iPhones in government business.
That's true.
Wow. This is quite a story.
This has been present for the last 5 years. This first appeared in the A12.
Wow.
Five generations ago.
And if they can do it once, they can do it again. There's no guarantee that.
That's exactly my point. If they turn this one off, it'll be in the next generation of silicon, and again, we'll have no idea.
Well, for all we know, there's three backdoors in the existing generation.
That's a very good point. That's a very good point. There could be two other hashes and the same access, so that if one is discovered, the other two remain active.
I am going to vote in favor of Apple and say they were compelled to do this by the NSA. They had no choice. They couldn't reveal it. They did it in as secure a way as possible.
That's all the evidence suggests that so far.
And I think in their favor, they had no choice. I mean, if the NSA says it, you get a national security letter. You don't have a choice. And there's a FISA court somewhere that ordered this. Wow. Wow. The problem with this is, you just listened to one of the most technical podcasts for the last 2 hours. There are very, very few people who would listen to this, understand it, and understand the implications. And that's another thing, that's another form of obscurity, because I wouldn't expect even Ron Wyden or his very, well, Chris Segoyan would understand. Maybe Chris Segoyan is whispering in Ron Wyden's ear right now and saying, hey, you know, this is a problem.
Yeah, we got to ask Apple, what the hell?
What is going on here? What a must-listen-to episode. As always, Steve, thank you so much for your deep work. When I said on MacBreak Weekly, I'm sure Steve will cover this, I had no idea how deep this rabbit hole was going to go. Fascinating. This is why you listen to the show, folks, and this is why you are a member of Club Twit, right? Very proud to say we passed 10,000 members in the last 24 hours. Which is great news. Our goal for the quarter is 15,000 members. Why is that important? Because the club is what's keeping this show on the air, period. Yes, we have sponsors. And the good news is this show has great sponsors. Many of our shows do, but also many of our shows have only one or two. And the way we're doing it now, we don't make as much money with the ads. Your help is much needed. And honestly, I think that's a good way to go. I like being supported by our audience. If you like what you hear on Twit, join Club Twit, $7 a month, ad-free versions of all the shows, access to the Discord, which is a great party, the good feeling that you're supporting something that really makes a difference in the world. And as we go forward, I think the job we're doing here at Twit becomes more and more important in this era. This is the only place you're going to get this kind of in-depth explanation of what's going on. I guarantee you there are 12 other podcasts who are listening right now who are going to attempt to duplicate Steve's in-depth research, but this is where you hear it for real, the original. Please join Club Twit if you're not already a member. twit.tv/clubtwit. And if you work for a company or you know somebody who you think should be advertising on this show or any of other shows, tell them, email advertising@twit.tv. We would like to get sold out. Our goals are to sell out and to get the club to 15,000. If we can do that in the next 3 months, we won't have to cut any more shows. We won't have to cut any more staff. We can even grow. But it takes all of us to do that. Steve Gibson is at grc.com. Spinright, what's going on? How soon? Don't say a date. That's all right. You can't win with a date.
I can't. I was actually a little frantic over the holidays trying to make my own deadline of before the end of the year.
Do it right.
And I have no choice.
Yeah.
It'll everyone will get the payback of my getting it done
right. This is why we love Steve. He does it right first. Doesn't wait. Say, I'll fix it in post. GRC.com, you can get a 6.0 version of Spinright, which is the current version. You'll get a free upgrade to 6.1 as soon as it's out. You'll be the first to know. You could even participate, as you can see, many have, in its development. GRC.com. While you're there, get a copy of the show. Steve has two unique versions of the show, a 16 kilobit audio version for people with very, very tiny bandwidth. And even smaller, a transcript created by a person with very, very tiny bandwidth, Elaine Ferris, who does a really good job of transcribing all these shows. In fact, every show has a transcript, which means you can search them. You can read along as you listen, and they're all there at grc.com. He's still on the Twitter for the time being, but his DMs are open, so you can DM him at sggrc is the Twitter handle. And, of course, we have copies of the show at our website, twit.tv/sn. In my opinion, my humble opinion, best thing to do is subscribe. You don't want to miss an episode of this. You might forget to download it. Don't forget. Your podcast client will just do it automatically, and that way you'll have it. And, you know, come a Wednesday morning, you go, oh, I want to hear Security Now. And it'll be right there for you. We like Pocket Casts if you're looking for a good podcast app. It's a very good one. Steve, Happy New Year. We're beginning 2024 with a bang. Holy
cow. You betcha.
Holy moly. We'll look forward to seeing you next week on Security Now.
And kids, do not create your EU to US power adapter using the photo shown at the top of the show.
No forceps, no lock and keys, no. Just because that's a disaster waiting to happen.
Hey, I'm Rod Pyle, editor-in-chief of Ad Astra Magazine, and each week I join with my co-host to bring you This Week in Space, the latest and greatest news from the final frontier. We talk to NASA chiefs, space scientists, engineers, educators, and artists, and sometimes we just shoot the breeze over what's hot and what's not in space books and TV. And we do it all for you, our fellow true believers. So whether you're an armchair adventurer or waiting for your turn to grab a slot in Elon's Mars rocket, join us on This Week in Space and be part of the greatest adventure of all time. Security.